What we're going to do today is to deal with something which I'll call more of a meta issue. Again, there's specific things in Parshat Re'eh, but there's more of a meta issue that I want to get to as we move on, as we make a little bit of progress. So let's just begin. V'haya, and this is not the very beginning, well, it's close. V'haya ki yaviyacha Hashem Elokecha el ha'aretz asher atabah shama lirishta. So when God brings you to this land, so it's also a couple things are interesting. One is Yaviyacha Hashem Elokecha, that God brings you to the land. So of course you can argue, or you can try to argue, okay, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean, and if Nefesh B'Nefesh brings you, then all this doesn't count? If Herzl brings you, then this doesn't count? Or one could say perhaps that whenever you are able to make it here, so then maybe that was Hashem Elokecha bringing you. But the other, as you just continue, because I really stopped too soon. Ela'aretz asher atah ba'a shama lirishta, and the word lirishta is a very important word, because the word indicates a yerusha, it indicates an inheritance, and once it's an inheritance, then all the rules seem to change. If I'll just pause there for a second. Later on, we're going to get to source 4, a very famous verse. Maybe the first ones that you learned. Torah tziva lenu Moshe Morasha Kilat Yaakov. So over here, the word Morasha is also an indication of an inheritance. And therefore, it would be extremely fair to say that there is, in fact, some type of an analogy between these two things, between Torah and between the land of Israel. And let me phrase it like this, and everything I'm about to say now for the next minute or two is really based upon a formulation of Rabbi Soloveitchik, that when it talks about the land of Israel, so who is the true owner of the land? You know, I said before, in terms of bringing us here, and I spoke about Herzl, which is obviously going to come from a secular Zionist place, and those of you a little bit more cynical can say, and coming to Israel wasn't his first solution to the Jewish problem, it wasn't a second solution to the Jewish problem, if you want to call it that, the Jewish problem. One of his solutions was, in fact, mass conversion, which he was talked out of. He was told that it won't necessarily work. Another solution, as I think is more well known, and that was to go to Uganda. Actually, that is a complete it was Uganda, but the place was not Uganda, is not what's called Uganda today. At one point, if anybody's ever going to write that Wikipedia page for me, so I'll give you some information, and I can give you the documents to support this. But at one point, I traveled to Nairobi, to Kenya, and I was offered to become the rabbi of the shul, which obviously they had to inflate it somewhat, so they called it the chief rabbi of Kenya. I mean, there was no other rabbi of Kenya. I don't know. It's a philosophical question. If you're the only rabbi, does that make you the chief rabbi? I mean, are you a chief if there are no Indians? I don't know exactly what it is that makes you chief rabbi. But listen, people have written worse things on their resumes, and this was actually true. I mean, aside from all the other incentives involved in it, but I got to meet somebody who was the head of the community. There were two interesting people at the heads. Well, I met the son of this couple, and they were actually the first Jews to get there. And his name was Abraham, and her name was Sarah. This is not going to get more biblical than that. But the story was is that they got inside information that Herzl was going to suggest Uganda, and which later on becomes Kenya. And like any good Jew would do, you know, heard all the other Jews are going, so they were wealthy, and they traveled down there and started buying up all the property in order to wait for this wave of immigration of Jews. And they own the hotels, and they own all kinds of things, but there's only one problem. It didn't work, but they got stuck there, and they built a shul, and so on and so forth. So that was the beginning of that community. So I go back to Herzl and going to the land. So, no, we're talking about the land of Israel, and the land of Israel. And the land of Israel is described as an inheritance. And the fact that it's described as an inheritance is really the issue that I wanted to develop a little bit. So the way that Rabbi Soloveitchik had put it, what would happen if every Jew in the world was to say that we hereby listen, the BDS is right, and the powers that be are correct, and we, you know, don't come from here. It's very interesting. Just, again, I don't want to get too carried off in this direction, but it's interesting when they say that we are European colonizers and so on. It sort of forgets all of the Jews who had formerly been in the Middle East and were kicked out of their lands and so on. People from Persia to Yemen, from North Africa, going, I mean, every single country around there was a Jewish community, and almost every country, and they were kicked out. So they were not colonizers coming from Europe. They were people who were really from this area, and they were, they probably as much right as some others, but I'm not going to get into politics because that really doesn't concern me as much. But what would happen if every Jew in the world and says that, you know what, we relinquish our rights to the land of Israel? So Rabbi Soloveitchik's point was, you don't own it. It's given to the entire Jewish people. And the entire Jewish people are not just the sum total of all the Jews who are alive today. It's all the Jews who are alive from the beginning of time until the end of time. And all that we are caretakers. And therefore, it's an inheritance. But it's an inheritance that we must pass on to the next generation. So therefore, I have no legal right to forfeit the inheritance which I need to pass on to the next generation. All that I can do is I can try to maximize it as much as possible, but it's not mine. The legal rights are not mine. And he said the same thing is true in terms of Torah. And that's going to be that comparison with Torah Tzivalenu Moshe. So Morisha, so it's also, it's an inheritance for the Jewish people. So therefore, you know, if you ever ask a rabbi a question, he doesn't want to answer you, which is interesting, especially if we get to a Ramban that I want to get to as we move on. And you then can say to him, excuse me, you are stealing from me my inheritance. That belongs to me. This knowledge that you have that you're not sharing with me is not your knowledge. Now, just if somebody writes a book, especially my books, then I have financial rights on that because of the work I put into it. But as far as the content goes, it belongs to Klal Yisrael. It does not belong to any individual. So therefore, there's a parallel over here between the Torah and the land of Israel, that it's something where the ownership, and again, I'm going back to my point, because both of them are referred to as an inheritance, but it's the inheritance of the entire Jewish people throughout history. So therefore, nobody can possibly say that I relinquish my rights to it, because your rights to it are essentially what I would call the rights of using it, of utilizing it, but essentially you need to pass it on, you know, move it forward. And it's not something that you have the ability of passing on, because you are not the owner. And I'll say it again, this was Rabbi Soloveitchik's formulation, even were every single Jew in the world to agree that we have no rights to Torah, we have no rights to the land of Israel, that the statement is null and void, it's a non-starter, because essentially they are not the owners, they are just someone who has inherited, there is a chain, and they've received it from the previous link in the chain, and their obligation is to pass it on to the next link in the chain. And I'm saying that, you know, just if you're, again, wondering, where did that come from? That's what emerges from the word Yerusha, or it's Lirishta. There's an inheritance. So that word is a very powerful word, because what it indicates is that this land is rightfully ours. God has promised this to Avraham, and as children of Avraham, we have inherited this. But I'll say it again, it's an inheritance which then moves forward to the entire Jewish people. And v'natata t'bracha al har grizim v'tekala al har eval. Halohema be'aver hayarden. So again, we're on the other side at this point, not yet having passed over. Acharei derech mavo hashemesh. So that's also a very interesting turn of phrase, which I may or may not come back to. But it's interesting just to call this thing about the sun over here. The sun is probably more important in this whole discussion than I'm going to let you know. But I'm just letting you know that it's more important than letting you know, which therefore now you should know it's very important. And it continues, and it says, "V'shamartem la'asot et kol ha'chukim ve'et ha'mishpatim asher anochi noten levneichem hayom." Our job, if we want to stay there, is we need to follow the statutes and the laws which God is placing in front of us. Now that's the end of Perek Yud Aleph. The continuation into Perek Yud Bet is probably a little bit more organic than it would look in your Chumash, although there is a pause here. Eila chukim v'mishpatim asher tishmurun lasot ba'aretz asher natan Hashem elokei avotecha lecha lirishta, which really the same theme is coming back in. So these are the chukim and the mishpatim that you have to guard in order to receive this land, in order to receive this inheritance, which means the inheritance, like lots of, you know, literature or movies, there's a condition to this inheritance. Yes, you get this money, but you need to do something in order to be able to deserve it, in order for this really to be yours. So then are here some rules are given. And over here, Pasuk Bet will tell us right away what it is that we need to do. Abed ta'abdun et kol ha'makomot asher avdu sham ha'goyim, asher atem yorshim otam. So again, you're inheriting this land, but all the idolaters who worshipped alien gods in this place, those need to be destroyed. Otim et Eloheihem, al harim haramim, upon the lofty or high hills, val hagvaot, and on the mountains and on the hills, v'tachat kol etz ra'anan, and under every leafy tree. V'nitatzem et mizbechotam, and you should destroy their altars, v'shibartim et matzvotev, and break the monuments, v'ashreyem tisrafun, and the trees that they worship should be burnt by ish, upsilei Eloheihem tegadeun, v'ibaratim et shmam min ha'makom ahu, destroy, wipe out, eradicate all mention of idolatry in this place. And then it says, lo tasu kein l'shem l'kechem, but don't do that to God. This, by the way, is one of the source, or the source, that you shouldn't erase God's name. You should destroy the idolatry and destroy the gods of, or the monuments and so on, of these other gods, but you shouldn't do this to God. The question is, what exactly does this mean, and how broad does this go? Are you allowed to destroy a shul, even in order to build a new shul? So all of this is going to revolve around this direct correlation between what it is that you destroy in terms of idolatry, but what you don't do in terms of when it comes down to God. I'm skipping a little bit, as you see, from Pasuk Dalet to Pasuk Yud Aleph, but it really should clearly be seen as a continuation. Vaya makom sheivchar Hashem Elokeichem bo l'shaken shmo sham, shama taviyu et kol asher anochi metzaveh etchem. Which means, after speaking about inappropriate idolatry or inappropriate ways of serving, so therefore it's serving the wrong God and in the wrong way, so now it talks about, and in the wrong place, it's under over every mountain, every hill, every leafy tree. And it's one of the things that I believe we've discussed in the past, that this really gives in to a great extent to immediate gratification. On the other hand, when it comes to the service of God, no, there's going to be centralized worship in one place, in that one place which is chosen, and that's the place that you should bring all of your offerings, olotechem v'zivchechem u'ma'asritechem u'trumat yedchem v'chol mivchar nidrechem asher tedru l'Hashem, all types of ways that you are obligated by God, or you've obligated yourself based on making a vow, all the things that you need to do to serve God, all the offerings that should be brought to this central place. So we have this distinction between avodah zarah versus avodat Hashem. And then there's something that maybe we will ignore, but we're not going to. Maybe it's ignored or not given enough emphasis. Usmachtem lefnei Hashem Elokeichem, and you should have joy in front of God. Now, this is going to be something which is going to come up moving forward in Kitavo as well. You should rejoice in front of God, the Lord your God. Atem uvneichem uvnoteichem, vavadchem va'amo va'am hoteichem. Now, and then it continues with Halevi and so on. Now, when you read this, certainly when you read it out of context, you don't necessarily get what I think is the deeper meaning in this. Because again, as of right now, it meant something which was very simple. The people who occupied this land beforehand served many gods in many inappropriate ways. You need to serve one God in an appropriate way. They had this immediate gratification and had idolatry in any place. And part of idolatry was this letting go and this I'm not sure what to call it. There was a frenzy involved in the idolatry, but it was one where, again, totally poor impulse control. And that was part of it. That was part of the letting go. That was part of the cultic behavior. And over here, we're talking about something which is much more staid, that being a litvak, partially at least, goes all the way back over here. Because on the other hand, said you have to be happy. So, you know, that's an avoda. That's that's an obligation over here. So that's something that, again, needs to be noted, that it's the contrast between the idolatry versus the service of God. Again, and that I want you, again, really to see clearly, but there's something else over here that is so easy to miss. And again, I'm saying it like it's a given. I may not be right about this, but, you know, I get overconfident sometimes, so I think that I'm right. So look how that verse then continues about being happy. It wasn't just that you're happy yourself, but rather it said that there are other people that need to be happy with you. And you're going to say, well, that's kind of obvious. U'smachtem l'fnei Hashem l'keichem, atem u'vneichem v'noteichem, and so on. And the Levi, and so on. And skipping a little bit now, we just now going Yud Aleph Yud Bet, skipping to Kaf Tet. Ki achrit Hashem l'keicha t'agayim asher tabah shama l'reshet otam mipanecha. Again, when, you know, these others, occupiers, they will no longer be here when you come to inherit your land. And you notice how many times the word l'reshet, yirashta, and so on is in this section. You realize that is a very strong component. V'yirashta otam v'yashafta ba'artzam. You're going then to inherit this land and settle in this land. By the way, one of the interesting things as we read this is the insistence upon some that living in the land of Israel may not really be a mitzvah. I don't want to minimize an important discussion, but you realize that as you read this, it's not such a simple argument to make that all of these verses didn't really mean what they say. I mean, they say that this is the place that you should inherit. This is the place that you should live. This is the place that God will take you to, and so on. So then how exactly do you then remove it from being an obligation? I mean, you can. If you want, I'll give you a way out. I don't believe that it's correct, but I can show you an example of somebody who makes a learned argument and saying why this really doesn't apply. Here, we'll move all the way down and we'll take a look. By Rav Tzadok in source number 12. Now, if you don't know, Rav Tzadok, a Kohen from Lublin, was an important Hasidic teacher, master, but, and this is why you have to have a little kavod for him, I'm not implying you don't have to have kavod for Hasidim, but you still should have a little kavod for his learning, because he was actually an incredible Talmud Chacham before he ever became a Hasid. Which means it was somebody who had a really important reputation as being a Talmud Chacham. And when he says something, it's not just, you know, what you would sometimes accuse of a Rebbe by saying, by Shalosh Shudas. Over here, he writes as follows. Mitzvah Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael Nirali Ikar Kamigilat Esther. That's a commentary on the Sefer Mitzvot. And he says, Dohu Bizman Shebeit HaMikdash Kayam. Ukalashon Akatuv, you know, going back to one of the verses we've seen, V'yarashtem ota v'yashavtem ba, v'gam einikra yishuv ela b'yishivat b'shalva. So that's very cute. I don't believe it's necessarily correct, but I'm going to explain that in a moment. But in another place, Rav Tzadok writes in Source 13, and he says, this is a Sefer Olot, where he writes, Dafka ach Yerushava hu kvushat tachat yad Yisrael. He goes, no, it really only applies when Israel is under Jewish control. So there's slight differences between the two of them, because one he writes only when the Beit HaMikdash is built, the other when it's under Jewish control, and you realize that that there's nonetheless a difference. He then continues and says, listen, it's still true nonetheless that a lot of Tanayim and Amorayim, especially Amorayim, spoke about the greatness of Israel. And he writes, just look at the very end, nobody's going to argue that living in Israel, gam bizman hazeh, even now, is an incredibly important thing. So even though he insisted, again, there was this dual insistence that he makes. One of them is that the mitzvah of living in Israel only really applies when there's a Beit HaMikdash. And his reasoning there was that then you have actual peace. Now, just by the way, that's not really true. That any time the Beit HaMikdash existed, there was a total peace and tranquility. I mean, you just have to think as simply the last couple of years before the Churban Bayit Sheni. There was not peace and tranquility during that time. There was a Beit HaMikdash. So it's not as simple as the way that he is putting it, But one of his arguments was, oh, only when it's under Jewish control. So that would be interesting today what he would say. But nonetheless, the way that he parsed it, oh, yeshiva, Yerushalmi yeshiva, yeshiva really means lashevet b'shalva. Because he goes back to this interesting turn of phrase by Yaakov, where it says, b'kesh Yaakov lashevet b'shalva, v'yeshev Yaakov, Yaakov settled in Israel, b'kesh Yaakov lashevet b'shalva, Yaakov was looking for tranquility. Those of you familiar with the Rashi and the Midrash, that is based on, excellent. But that's a little far-fetched. By the way, far-fetched is one of the words in English that if you say it right, everyone will think it's Yiddish. Just say it. It's far-fetched. So, right, it definitely sounds like a Yiddish word. But as far as I know, it's English. Although, it would be quite amusing if it actually came from Yiddish, but it doesn't. So, anyway, it's a little far-fetched to go and to claim that when the Torah says you should live in the land, he says, no, you only live in the land when there's total tranquility. What? Excuse me, that means you never have to fight for the land? No. V'yirashtemota sometimes means that you have to fight for it. In another class within the last 2 months, so we were talking about Shemitah. I don't know how. And today maybe we'll get to Shemitah as well. I live with a Shemitah obsession right now. All the books over here now, all the Shemitah books are now. And so somehow along the way, somebody had asked me something about going up to the Temple Mount. So, it, by the way, I'm not going to do the whole thing, but it has to do with the question of the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael right now. So, according to most opinions, there is not a sufficient expression of Kedusha to say that Shemitah exists on a Torah level. So, if there's not enough Kedusha that Shemitah exists on a Torah level, so who said you have to live here? I remember one of the times that I taught this, people look, oh, there's no Kedusha, there's no Kedusha. No, there's no Kedusha in terms of Shemitah. Shemitah has certain rules to it. One of the rules, according to Rashi and according to the Rambam, is that you need all 12 tribes to be in their proper place. So therefore, if Shevet Gad, right, and Menasha, do not have, Reuven, do not have the other side of the Jordan, most of the tribe living in each of their places, then Shemitah doesn't apply on a Torah level. Now that doesn't have very much to do with the mitzvah today and the Kiddush of Yerushalayim and living in Yerushalayim, but it has to do with the interpretation of Gemara, whereby the Rambam thinks that the land of Israel, in terms of Shemitah, does not have Kedusha, but Yerushalayim and the Har Habayis has Kedusha. On the other hand, the Ravid thinks that the Har Habayis doesn't have Kedusha, but the land of Israel does have Kedusha. So it's a very interesting argument in terms of how they understand certain Gemaras, Kedusha Rishona, Kedusha Shnia. It's very simply, what was the Gemara talking about when it said this? So according to the Ravid, and this, by the way, you can argue with me as well, exactly what the Ravid means, and if I'm overstating the Ravid, I apologize, but I'm stating it as I understand it. The Ravid would say that if you went up to the Temple Mount today, there is absolutely no prohibition whatsoever. Now, what he actually writes is there's no chiyuv karet. So you can say, oh, he doesn't say it's mutter, he just said there's no chiyuv karet. But that's not what he means. What he means is there's no chiyuv karet because there's no kedusha. That's exactly his point. There's no kedusha right now whatsoever to the Har Habayit. The Rambam would say there is kedusha to Har Habayit, but there's no kedusha to Eretz Yisrael. The Rav would say there's no kedusha to the Har Habayit, but there is kedusha to the rest of Eretz Yisrael. I hope that was not overly confusing, but Rav Goren, who right after the Six-Day War encouraged all kinds of Chavrei Knesset to come up to Temple Mount. Now, here's a second thing that you may or may not know. My father's good friend, who should have refuah shleima, Rabbi Moshe Tendler, on multiple occasions went up to the Har Habayit. And if you were to ask him why, he would say, I mean, those of you who don't know who he is, he's a very serious Talmud Chacham. He also happens to be the son-in-law of, one can argue, shouldn't argue, the Gadol Hador, a man by the name of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Matter of fact, if you look in the writings of Rav Moshe, Igros Moshe, not totally obscure. It's only obscure if you never heard of this before and never saw it. Rav Moshe says you can go up to Har Habayis if you went to mikveh. If you went to mikveh, you can go to Har Habayis. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes this. Anybody who wants this, the source, I'm happy to give you the source. And no, I've never gone up to the Har Habayis for multiple reasons. But Rav Goren encouraged all kinds of Chavrei Knesset who didn't go to mikveh, who would never go to mikveh and so on, to go up to Har Bayis. So people asked, how can you do this? I mean, it's not allowed. So he said, no, each time somebody goes up, it then strengthens our hold on it, and it's part of the mitzvah of fighting for Eretz Yisrael, the mitzvah of Yerusha v'Yeshiva. And sometimes the war is fought with guns and sometimes with knives and sometimes with tanks and sometimes by PR and sometimes by public opinion and therefore if Goren argued, no, of course they can go up. That's the wars going on. The more Chavrei Knesset that feel connected to this place, the better chance we'll have to hold on to it. Now, I'm not asking you to agree with me or to disagree with me, but that's very interesting. And I want to go back to the point that you may have heard me make before. My point is that, you know, when Tzadik says, no, it's only mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael when it's easy, yeah, you know what? You can argue about a Tosfos and so on who says, listen, how can you go to Israel? It's very, very dangerous. Essentially saying is that the chances of successfully getting there are minimal. That's not where Rav Tzadik went further than Tosfos went. That there, if any danger would get rid of the mitzvah living in Israel, we never would have entered Israel because there was always danger in terms of capturing it, in terms of going to war. War, by the way, there's a Menchas Chinuch like this. War is dangerous, so therefore, how can you ever allow danger? Well, sometimes you need to fight in order to protect, in order to, shall we say, that the prerequisite for the inheritance of the land of Israel sometimes is fighting for it. I'll tell you another secret. We're going to give you all this. This is all to make up that I'm not going to tell you the secret that the Ramban says for a simple reason. I don't understand it, but during one of the last couple of wars, not the most recent one, I was asked the question by a student who was working in the newsroom for an important media outlet. I'll just put it like that so there's no you won't know exactly who it is I'm talking about. And he said that normally when it comes to Shabbos, he makes sure that he doesn't have a shift on Shabbos and he stays home with his family on Shabbos. And he the question that he asked then was, giving us the dates of Rav Tzadok, 1823 to 1900. That's Rav Tzadok, correct? So he said to me that if he doesn't take his job and doesn't go in on Shabbos, he's worried that the news will not be reported accurately. And he said that the war is a war which is being fought in terms of PR and so on. And I'll just continue the argument. If somebody goes and reports the news, it can save the lives of soldiers. It can absolutely save the lives. And did I say enough in order to tell you if I allowed him to go work on Shabbat to be able to report the news? Yes, because I believe that it was part of the war effort, and I believe that it was Pikuach Nefesh was involved in this. And anybody wants to disagree with me, it's fine. You want to shut off the Zoom right now and say, listen, I'm not listening to him anymore. But you know what? We live in a new world. And part of the issue of reporting something or reporting something wrong puts us in a precarious situation. So therefore, if, let's just say, a school in Gaza gets bombed and people get killed, God forbid, and then Israel gets attacked and therefore they become hesitant the next time. But on the other hand, somebody reports they were shooting rockets out of that school and that changes the whole complexion of it. So I'll say it again, reporting what actually happened accurately, I believe, is part of the war effort. And I believe that that is included in legitimate reason for this person to have gone in and to work and to do the job that he needed to do. And he was not the only person to have asked me a question like this. And again, if I've left you guessing what my answer is, then I apologize. But I believe you can figure out what it was that I answered. So let's get back now to our Yerusha and Yeshiva. So it could, now the other way, again, it continues that, let's just see exactly where we're up to, right? Pasuk Kaftet. Right, we're going to again, Lereshet Otam Efnecha V'Yarashta Otam V'Yashavta Ba'artzam. So I'll say it again. Yeah, you can argue like Rav Tzadok did that it doesn't really mean you should live there, but it says you should live there. It says this is your inheritance, and you should V'Yashavta Ba'artzam, in the land that once belonged to others. Hishamer Lecha Pitunakei Shachareim. Be very careful, you know, not to follow their ways, not to follow their idolatry, and so on. Or even to say, let me go and follow their practices. This is local custom, right? When in Rome, follow Rome. When in in Canaan, follow the Canaan worship. Lo ta'asak hein la'Hashem elokecha. No, don't serve that way. Ki kol to'evat Hashem asher saneh asula Elohim. Things which are detestable to God is the way they behave. Gam et b'neihem v'b'noteihem yisrafu ba'esh l'Elohim. And they even did something which we know by name called Molach, and they did child sacrifice, and they burnt their children to their gods. So it's at this point I want to go backwards and now point out that contrast. When it talked about our going up and not doing idolatry, but rather one central worship, and then it added, and it said, not only is there going to be this central worship, but you should worship with your children and make them happy and to celebrate with them, your sons and your daughters and your families. So I said, that all that was nice by itself. But I don't think any of us realized till I just now pointed out, look at the contrast that's right afterwards. Don't follow the pagan practices. Don't do what they do. And don't slaughter your children, which means now just think about the difference. Don't slaughter your children versus celebrate and make your children happy. And unfortunately, we're going to get far too political today, but unfortunately, there's still people today who are sacrificing their children in situations. And we'll leave it at that. So, the contrast there is really what I find the most significant. And again, you rather you follow what God has ordered. There's similar things back in Ve'et Hanan, where it says, Shemur tishmur na mitzvot Hashem alokeichem ve'edot tav v'chukotav, v'zite yashav atov b'nei Hashem, l'man yitav lach, in order for you to inherit it, then you need to do what's proper in God's eyes and not do, you know, these other things that others do. Also, it's mentioned in contest with Shoftim, coming up soon, Tzedek Tzedek Terdof, L'man Tichyeh V'Yirashta Ta'aretz. That one of the ways, when we read before, Mishpatim, Chukim, and so on, well, one of the things is actually connected to making a legal system, and having a land of justice is going to help us deserve to live in this land. So, moving now to source number 5, which is still, we're in Re'eh, but we would have thought this was completely disconnected, and that we've skipped a little, Navi Sheker along the way, things that are important. He shemer lecha penya davar im levavcha li'al lemor korva shnata sheva shnata shmita. See, we got back to shmita. So I want to preface this and talk a little bit about what this is going to tell us now. We already know Parshat Bahar, or as already mentioned earlier in Parshat Mishpatim, there is this kind of working for 6 years and resting on the 7th year. But aside from the idea, the agricultural aspect, there's also this whole other, shall we call it, a financial aspect to the laws of Shemitah. And here's something which I wonder. One of the things that, you know, maybe we're familiar with, which is probably one of the least understood laws, and that is this law, which is in the Mishnah. It's in the Mishnah both in Shvi'it, in Shvi'is, and in Gittin. And it talks about Prizbul. It says that Hillel Zaken sees that people aren't lending money, so therefore he makes Prizbul. Why? Because Shemitah cancels loans. So Shemitah cancels loans, but you can't cancel loans if people gave loans. So why would people need loans on Shemitah? Because especially people working in agriculture are not going to have money because they have to let the land lie fallow, and that which grows by itself they have to make ownerless. So therefore they're not going to have finances. So what happens instead? So I'm explaining it now, and I've said this before, the way the Chizkuni explains it, and that is, who's going to need money? The ones who don't have any income coming in. Who's going to have extra money? The guy who doesn't work in agriculture. So therefore, the tailor and the woodchopper and the others who have, the guy in high tech, the lawyers, they're going to have money while the other people don't have money. So you lend money to the guy who you've been eating it from his field all year, and that creates this type of what we can call social justice. So then it's a mitzvah at the end for you to cancel your loan and say, no, you keep the money. The guy says, oh, I'm going to pay you back. No. Even though you borrowed money, it's fine, you keep it. It's a mitzvah to cancel the loan. Now, what happens when Shemitah is drabanan? So, at that point, and again, this is the way I'm understanding, and I'm following Rashi, and I'm following the Rambam, and I'm following others, that say that the idea that Hillel made of Prizbul, which allows you to ask for your money back, and to get the money back from the loans, that's only when Shemitah is Drabanan. So I think if we read the verses carefully again, we may find something which is interesting. Because what is it that the verse says? Be careful that when the seventh year comes and you see the difficulty that your brother is in, right, and he's going to ask for money, give him and don't have your heart, you know, full of poison, but to know low, you know, when you give him. This is going to bring you blessing. This is one of the things that is going to bring you blessing. It continues, but again, we'll explain soon. And it goes into, again, right afterwards, Pasuk Yud Aleph to Yud Bet, it talks about slavery and allowing the slave to go through in the seventh year. And in the end, it ends up by saying, V'zacharta ki evri yitaberitzam, you were a slave in Israel, and God redeemed you. Al-kein anochi mitzavcha et hadavar hazeh hayom. And therefore, I'm commanding you of this thing. So you note the Shemitah year with its financial aspect to it. And it says, be careful, you know, lend the person the money. When Shemitah comes, don't make it difficult to get a loan that year. So I wonder, and I'm wondering this out loud now, I wonder if in today's world, when Shemitah's Drabanan, but somebody still needs money, and you're going to say, okay, Shemitah's Drabanan, but also Shemitah Ksafim is Drabanan, I'm not going to lend money. I wonder if you're breaking a Torah law by not lending the money. Because I understand that Shemitah, which I'll say it again, letting the landline fallow, or the Kedusha Ha'aretz, that's limited to certain conditions. The idea of the loans, of the return of the loans, that's connected. There's a linkage between that and the between Shemitah Karka and Shemitah Ksafim, which is. But what about my refusal to lend the person the money? I wonder. And again, this is something which one has to really look at all the Sefer HaMitzvot and the various commentaries. But I wonder if Hillel perceived. By the way, I think that what I'm saying is true. If you look at the Mishnah. I wonder if Hillel perceived that refusal to lend money is breaking the Torah law, even when Shemitah is Drabanan. When the seventh year is coming, you can say, no, it doesn't mean only the seventh year that is in all ways actionable, or is it the seventh year because it's the seventh year, even though Shemitah doesn't count? So I wonder about, the reason why I wonder about that is, I don't have it in front of me now, but the language of the Mishnah is that Hillel saw that they were being over Mashekatuv B'Torah. He saw them breaking a Torah law by not lending money. So it could well be that not lending money to a brother in need, and just realize something, the main Staka discussion is in this context. These are the main verses in Bihar and again over here about what we call the mitzvah tzedakah. Leave a second the idea of the agricultural, of giving meiser. Think instead about opening up your hand, as it says over here, and giving somebody money in need. Here, I'm going to say something which I'm going to get kicked out of the rabbis' union. If I were a member of the RCA, they would expel me for this for sure, but I'm not a member, so it's fine. Like every rabbi is going to get up and say that, you know, you're not allowed to test God. But when it comes to one particular mitzvah, you can test God. What mitzvah is that? By tzedakah. That's all very nice, except for one problem. It doesn't say that. It says you can test God by meiser, which means this is a mitzvah of living in Israel when you give meiser. It's not the meiser that somebody gives over from their finances. Maybe God will help them as well. I can't tell you when he does, when he doesn't, but I could tell you what that discussion is in. And it just became very, very easy for me. By the way, this is a very big argument, whether giving ma'aseh is a Torah law, rabbinic law, or a custom. And it seems to be that the strongest argument is that it is, in fact, a custom. And there's many, many questions that emerge from what I'm saying right now. Nonetheless, I've said it. But the concept of giving tzedakah, which is independent from the agricultural laws, but realize now that they are connected on some way. I mean, it's always interesting in the Rambam to look where he placed something. Where did he place the laws of Matanot Aniyim? In which section? It's in Zrayim. It's in the laws of agriculture. Why? Because on a biblical level, it seems to very well to be connected to it. Why? You look right here in the agricultural discussion, it also talks about lending money and giving people money, but it's not divorced from it. It really is interrelated. Okay, having said that, let's, and by the way, many times I've been asked questions by people, especially younger couples or people. Just recently, somebody had a wedding and we got presents. Do they have to give maestro and everything? So I say, slow down a second. Slow down. First of all, did anybody ever tell you this is a Torah law, or what do you know about it? They don't know. So I say, okay, let's just follow this approach for a moment. And I'm following very much Rav Avadia. And if you want, for those of you who live in Israel, I can follow Rav Waldenberg as well, it's Eliezer, that it's a custom. So therefore, if you know it's a custom, right? If you know it's a custom and you've been doing it, sorry, I'll go the other way around. Let's say you didn't know it's a custom and you've been doing it and you thought it's an obligation. Any kind of halacha that you've been doing that you thought was an obligation, but it turned out only to be a custom, at that moment, you don't even have to be matur neder, because you did this custom based upon thinking it was an obligation and not realizing it was only a custom. So I'm going to full stop or pause there for a moment. So if somebody says, I've always been giving maestros, now don't get me wrong, I think it's a very good thing, but let's just say, in order to go to work, you need to pay the bus or the train or put gas in the car, this amount. That's a deductible for maestro. You need to buy certain clothing that you can go to work with. That's a deductible for maestro. Which means even figuring it out. Now, what Rav Waldenberg claims is that paying Israeli taxes, being that it goes to the upkeep of a Jewish state, all counts towards Meiser. And if that's the case, I'm not giving 10%. I'm not even giving 20%. I'm giving so much Meiser, I can't even call it Meiser anymore. I'm doing it with Ayin Yafeh beyond any kind of imagination. But Rav Waldenberg says that's legitimate. By the way, Rav Avadia then gives a whole argument, anybody paying day school tuition, he claims, if, and again, all this is based on the Gemara, if a kid is over 6 years old, you have no real obligation to be paying for them. And by the age of six, somebody can work already. That was the perception of the rabbis in the time of the Gemara. So you're only obligated till six. After six, you don't have to do it. So why are you giving it? You're giving staka. So you're giving staka. That becomes a deductible. So I'm going to say it again. I think that many of us are going far beyond our obligation. By the way, the problem with what I'm saying is that shuls will never be built and people would never, all kinds of institutions are going to fall apart. I mean, how much can we do just based upon guilt? Well, maybe we could do a lot. There's lots of things built based upon guilt. But just realize as we're reading this, part of what we're looking at, again, I just want to focus on Parshat Re'eh right now. It is a destructive society which is going to be eradicated. On the other hand, we're walking in there and we need to build a different kind of society, including one with what we can call social justice by putting our hands out and helping those in needs and giving people loans when they need the loans and then just adding that other step and sometimes by even forgiving loans when we need to forgive those loans. But all of this is this contrast between the corrupt society that lived beforehand. And I'll say it again, reading that beautiful description, and you'll celebrate with your children and so on. We didn't get what that verse meant until you read further and you realize that there is a contrast which is being put forward to us over here. So let's continue a little bit more. What we had just now seen is that there is this obligation to destroy Avodah Zarah. On the other hand, there is this obligation for us in order to be nice to one another. Moving to six, here, getting towards the end of the parasha, it talks about the holidays. Now, over here, the easy read on all this, till we see the difficulties, is why the holidays introduced again. And the answer is because it's the holidays as related to this temple, to the centralized worship, to the Beit HaMikdash. We get to the holiday of Pesach in source number 6. Shemort Chodesh Aviv, Vasita Pesach Lashem Elokecha. Right? Okay, remember the springtime in Pesach. That's when you came out of Egypt and so on. Vizabachta Pesach Lashem Elokecha, Tzon Avaka, Bamakom Hashem Chara Hashem Lashekin Shemol Sham. Serve God in that place. And that should have been enough. Lo Tochal Alav Chametz. Okay, adding a little bit more laws. Right? 7 days. Shabbat Yamim. Tochal Alav Matzot. Lechem oni, ki bechipazon. So now again, it's things we know, but it's giving us more information than we needed at this point. Okay, so Moshe's repeating a little bit. Yitzat me'eretz Yitzrayim, leman tiskor yom tzedcha me'eretz Yitzrayim kol yimei chayecha, which is again another addition that was not necessary, but get the pasuk dalet. V'lo yirelecha sa'or b'chol gvulecha shivat yamim. The b'chol gvulecha is very interesting. In all of your places, you should not have any kind of chametz. So that's interesting. V'lo yalin min habasar shetizbach be'erev yom rishon levoker, meaning that was part of the context. Don't leave any of the Korban Pesach over, but this idea of making sure that you have no chametz at all. Again, going back to the centralized worship, and by the way, I wonder about the Shemesh again, because when it comes to the Egyptian story, the sun is much more important, especially Paro and the sun god and so on. And we also know that there was some worship of the sun in Eretz Yisrael as well, but as I said, I was just hinting about all of that and leave it. And again, over here, it gave us a little more information, and I need to pause over here. The obligation of getting rid of chametz, and that's what I'm talking about over here, as more of a macro issue, is that there is a great deal of similarity between the destruction of Avodah Zarah, which was mentioned earlier in the parsha, and the destruction of chametz. Meaning chametz all year round is not chametz. Okay, so we know that. But then suddenly Pesach comes and now we have this obligation to get rid of it. Now, how you get rid of it is also really quite intriguing. Rabbi Yehuda said that you must actually physically destroy it. And incidentally, that it becomes very, very close to the concept of getting rid of Avodah Zarah. But again, I'll need to qualify this a little bit. Ironically, somehow in the middle we got to Shemitah, because it was also in Re'eh. When it comes to Shemitah, you're allowed to eat the produce the whole time that it's in the field that animals can access it. When animals can't access it, then there's a mitzvah of what's called biur. So also with, let's say, undertones from the Pesach story, what exactly is biur when it comes to Shemitah? According to the Ramban, biur means to make it ownerless, just like we do with chametz. We declare the chametz ownerless. According to the Rambam, the way that you do biur of Shemitah, once that's no longer in the field and the animals can't access it, the Rambam says you must destroy it at that point. You must do ein biur, ein biur Shemitah elas reifa. That's the way the Rambam understands it. It's very much like we understood Rabbi Yehuda by chametz, or we should understand by idolatry. So therefore, these three things are things that become contraband. Again, idolatry is always contraband. The chametz is contraband only 1 week a year, but that was interesting that was thrown into this discussion over here. And Shemitah was also thrown in along the way over here, so I'll stress that as well. There is this idea that you must do something with it. So now the question is, the getting rid of the Shemitah produce, is it more similar to getting rid of Avodah Zarah, or is it more similar to getting rid of chametz? Well, if it is chametz, it's not according to Rabbi Yehuda, but it's according to the others who say that you just have to do, you know, bitul midoraisa is enough, you just have to make it ownerless. So I'll say it again. On a halachic level, everything I've just now said is significant, and someone can give a purely halachic chabura on those three different points of reference. Avodah Zarah, when it comes to Shemitah Pradus after the time, and when it comes to Chametz on Pesach, or before, right before Pesach, or after Pesach. But on a Hashkafa level, then all of this becomes incredibly interesting, and I'm not taking you all the way to, you know, the finish line on this. I'm just telling you that there's what to think about over here, you know, especially when it comes to the comparison between Pesach and getting rid of your Chametz versus destruction of idolatry. I do want to, in order to, for all of this to make a little more sense, we're going to quickly look at three sources. Source seven is the Mishnah in Psachim, where we have this idea that once the chametz is not allowed to be used, Rabbi Yehuda Omer Ein Biur Chametz Ela Sreifa. Rabbi Yehuda says the only way to get rid of it is by burning it. No, you just got to get rid of it. You can crumble it up and throw it into the wind, or have it thrown into the sea. Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchot Avodat Kochavim, when it's talking about idolatry, mitzvah kol amotzi avodat kochavim sheyivarena v'yabdena. There's a mitzvah to burn it, right? Beer. V'ketzem v'ara, how do you do it? Shochek v'zorei l'ruach amatil l'yam. you're allowed to take it, and you're allowed to crumple it up or throw it into the river. Now you realize something that, again, I'm not doing this the way it should be done. If we were talking about halacha, I'm just pointing out that there's an echo of the discussion of chametz when it comes to avodah zarah, or the other way around, is that chametz on Pesach takes upon this idea of avodah zarah. Maybe I'll be a little bit clearer about this, but we need the Rambam in source number 9 to be clearer. Mitzvah aseh hi la'abed avodah zarah umisham sheha v'kol ha'naaseh b'shvilah. Everything connected to idolatry, you have to get rid of it. Shenemar, back in our parsha, abed ta'abdun et kol ha'makamot. Get rid of these things. V'nemar ki imko na'aseh mizvachem titatzu. Again, all of this back in a Devarim perspective. Uve Eretz Yisrael, mitzvah lirdof achareha. In the land of Israel, you need to find it. You need to search for it. An shenabed ota mikol artzenu, until we rid it completely from our land. Avo b'chutz la'aretz, when it comes to outside of Israel, ein anu mitzvah lirdof achareha. You don't have to go searching for it. Ela kol makom shenichbosh oto nabed kol avodah zarah shebo. That if you happen to, you bought something, you bought a house, and there's an avodah zarah tree in the backyard, you have to get rid of the tree. You don't have to go searching for your neighbor's tree. Vivadatem et shma min hamakom mahu. Be'eretz Yisrael atam mitzvah lirdof achareihem, ve'ein atam mitzvah lirdof achareihem b'chutz la'aretz. Now, all of that is really interesting, which means that when it comes to our obligation or our orientation towards avodah zarah, so now just go back to the Pesach thinking. I'm sorry if I keep going backwards and forwards. Think about chametz now. Chametz becomes something which is incredibly similar to avodah zarah in Eretz Yisrael, that I have to go searching for it and making sure it's completely my home, my palace, is completely chametz-free. The same way that Eretz Yisrael has to be completely avodah zarah-free. So again, on the halachic level, there is what to analyze, but I'm not talking purely on the halacha level. On the other hand, when it comes to chutz la'aretz, then I don't have to go and make sure that there's no avodah zarah in the whole place. They're going to worship, that's their problem. I don't have to deal with it. It's only if it came into my possession. But this idea of searching for it creates this analogy between Pesach and between avodah zarah. And I'll say it again, that's something which is interesting. There were a number of Hasidic Rebbes who came and moved to Eretz Israel. They moved to Tel Aviv. And some people say, why in Tel Aviv? Tel Aviv is not so holy, right? It's full of, there was this one fellow who said, Rav Yisachar Temer, he wrote a book, The Yad Tamar, and he wrote that Tel Aviv is full of chol, right? But he was talking about the beaches. It's full of chol. It's full of, but chol also not kodesh. And our obligation is to turn it into something which is kodesh. But a number of rebbes moved to Tel Aviv for a very simple reason. And they, what do they say? It's the only city in Israel. Again, remember, Tel Aviv was built not all that long ago. And when they moved there, they said, look, Yerushalayim is full of churches. Yerushalayim is full of mosques. The holiest places that we have places of alien worship over there. Tel Aviv doesn't have any of these places. Again, not yet. I don't know what they have in Tel Aviv now. And some would argue that Tel Aviv has lots of other things. But they said, there's no avodah zarah there. This is the best place to live in Eretz Yisrael because it's a brand new city without any of those things. By the way, Givat Zev, where I live, does not have any places of foreign worship in any way, shape, or form. And so maybe that's why we live here. So as we are beginning to run out of time, so there's really two things that I want to get to still. One is the Ramban. In source number 10, we need for the Ramban in 11, but this is the Ramban. Not that it's the only one, but this is the really the powerful Zionist Ramban. And the Ramban, it's not fair to use those kind of terms, even if they're true. Over here, this Ramban is in source 11, and he's talking in Vayikra, Perek Yud Chet, and he's talking about that the land will vomit up those who don't follow. And primarily, this section is talking about the inappropriate sexual relations. And one of the ideas the Ramban is going to develop is that the land of Israel is a place, and those of you who heard me speak on Tisha B'Av, I did speak about this a little bit. It's the place which is much more micromanaged when it comes to God, as opposed to places which has more of a macro type of management, and even something called angels and powers and so on. Even though the Ramban insists, of course, we believe in one God and God is in control of everything, the direct interest and involvement of God in Israel is just fundamentally different. And he doesn't explain this in a way that I think that all of us will be satisfied with if I would try to explain it. But it's what he says, and if you look over the sources afterwards, then maybe you will be satisfied. He continues along the way, and he tells us, and he quotes, just for example, some other sections, and it's interesting, he actually moves over to Avodah Zarah, and one of the things that he points out is that the prohibition of Molech, which we mentioned before, of burning, sacrificing kids, is actually mentioned in the context of Arayot, which means it's this, there has always been this fascinating spillover effect or interrelationship between idolatry and between sexual outrage. Which means the Gemara goes so far as to say that Jews didn't believe in the idolatry, but it allowed all kinds of behavior that they thought was. I mean, just think about, sorry for interrupting myself in the middle, but think about the 60s of some, Jewish guy who's going to move to a commune. Free love, by the way, it doesn't really mean free love. It meant free something else. So, but they called it love. So, all I have to do is I have to wear a tie-dye jeans, or I just have to wear this and this and listen to Jerry Garcia and so on and so forth, and then all these things become allowed. So he said, that's exactly what the Gemara says. The Jews didn't believe in all of these things, but it allowed the types of behavior that was generally looked upon in a way that it wasn't acceptable, let's put it that way. And now that's a society which allows these things. And that's the Ramban. That's the Ramban's really, it's one of the larger points that he's making, is that there is this spillover effect and interrelationship between idolatry and between sexual outrage. And both of these things, because the land of Israel is God-saturated, it becomes super inappropriate for these things to be done in this particular land. And as I said, along the way, he comes back to this idea of Moloch and this type of a society. And he will explain over here again about the land of Israel specifically. He'll also say that's why Yaakov was able to marry two wives who were sisters outside of the land of Israel, but in the land of Israel, that becomes inappropriate. And I'll say more along those lines as well. At some point, he'll tell us that there is this incredible secret involved in this. I'll read this for you, and then I won't explain it. Ve'ein reshut lefaresh be'inyan ha'aretz yoter mizeh. That's all I can say. Aval im tiskeh la'avin ha'aretz rishina niskeret pa'pasuk bereshit. But if you understand the first time the word ha'aretz is mentioned bereshit, ve'haniskeret pa'parashit im b'chukotai, then you'll understand the secret. So now all of you at least know where to look. He goes, I've given you enough hints, and that's all that I'm going to say. And the Ramban is telling us about some type of a relationship between heaven and earth, specifically in Israel, on how what takes place in heaven is mirrored by what takes place on earth, or maybe what takes place on earth is mirrored in heaven. But he's saying there is this this inner relationship. And again, this is the Ramban who absolutely believes that there's an obligation to live in the land of Israel, because he just believes that that there is this incredible amount of holiness and saturation. I want to end with one last thought for today. It's really based on source 14. It's the Sifri. But just first, let me make an observation. A lot of people actually ignore this halacha, that when you come to Israel, you haven't been there ever, or certain places, you see the Temple Mount, you see cities destroyed, you're supposed to tear Kriya, right? This is one of the things that we do, Zecher L'Chorban. There's different kinds of things that are Zecher L'Chorban, and it's interesting. Some things that we have are Zecher L'Chorban, and it goes back to Yochanan Zakkai. And some of the things that we have are Zecher L'Mikdash, which means, just for example, we have a custom. We'll talk about a wedding. You have a custom by a wedding to break a glass by the wedding, and it's Zecher L'Chorban. On the other hand, when the mitzvah of lulav is only mitzvah for one day outside of the Beis HaMikdash, and we take it for 7 days, that's zecher l'mikdash. So there's certain halachot which are zecher l'chorban, and there's certain halachot which are zecher l'mikdash. So one of the things, zecher l'chorban, is a person supposed to tear kriya. You know, tearing kriya can be very traumatic. It's a very traumatic thing to tear kriya. Somebody's ever torn kriya for a loved one, it's a very traumatic thing. You get through flame, so it's a tear kriya. So a lot of people get out of this. They don't do it. They go on Friday. By the way, the poskim don't understand at all. Why? If you go on Friday, it doesn't count. If you go Friday in the afternoon, why doesn't it count? Nobody knows. The other thing which is interesting is that it's a mitzvah d'rabbanan. Just think of how much money people spend for a Hanukkah. You know, menorah or Chanukiah. They'll buy a nice silver one. They'll spend all kinds of money. And it's a mitzvah d'rabbanan. But it comes to tearing. No, listen, I'm not going to tear my shirt. It costs a lot of money. So just a very funny thing that certain mitzvos we like more. We like the latkes more than you like the Torah. I mean, I understand this, but I'm just pointing it out that it's interesting. But keeping that in mind, I want to read this Sifri because it's really, it flips it around. Because I think for a lot of people today, there is an educational message over here. And it goes back to Yochum and Zakkai. What's the educational message? Yes, there may be a mitzvah, Yerusha and Yeshiva, and it's our inheritance, and we're supposed to be there, supposed to settle there, supposed to live there. But look, you come to Eretz Israel, you haven't been there, you come and you tear Kriya. What are you tearing Kriya? Israel's not what it should be. And that's true. Israel's not what it should be. But there's a message in this. And that's what leads me back to this Sifri, which I said we'll finish with. Ki yachrit Hashem elokech et ha-goyim, which goes back to our, right, Parshat Ra'eh, to our, one of the psukim we saw before. Asei mitzvah umura b'inyan shebischara yachrit Hashem elokech et ha-goyim. Right? You should do the commandments which are going to facilitate our allowing to be here. Asher tabasham al resh rotam yipanecha bischar shetavo shetirash. We have to come. We have to come in and inherit it. How do you do it? V'yirash motav yishavtem b'ratzan. So I'm going to skip a little bit. V'yirashta otam v'yashafta. Maaseh Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira. Now, if you don't remember Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira, he was one of these chachamim who the Romans were trying. He gave smicha. Was supposed to give smicha. The Romans were chasing him down. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira ends up escaping from Israel and being in Chutzlaretz. There's a number of gemarot where he. Where they say, oh, even though he's sitting far away, he still was able to see things in Yerushalayim that people, others don't. Weren't able to see standing there. If you know what I'm talking about, excellent. It was a Gemara. If you're learning Daf Yomi, it should have been very recently in the in Pesachim. So it says that once Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira, Rabbi Matthew ben Charish, Rabbi Hananiah ben Achi, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Yonatan, Shayu Yotzim Chutz La'aretz, V'giyel Paltam, V'zachru Et Eretz Yisrael, Zakfu Einem, V'zilgul Demoteim, V'koru Bigdeim, V'koru Et HaMikra Hazeh, V'yirashtem Atav, V'yishavtem Ba, U'shmartem Lasor Kol Chukim Ha'eleh. Amru Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael Shkula K'neged Kol Mitzvot Shebetorah. That instead of tearing Kriya when they get to Eretz Yisrael, they tear Kriya when they leave, when they get to Chutz La'aretz. Which means that, you know, based, I'll read one more and then I'll say the conclusion. Masiv Yerid Lez Ben Shemur, V'yochana Sanlar, Shriyoholchim L'Nitzivim Eitzol V'Yehuda Ben Beteira, L'mod Meno Torah, V'Giyu L'Tzaydan, V'Zachru Et Eretz Yisrael, Zagfu Einem V'Zilgul D'Motayim. They're traveling to see their Rebbe. They want to learn. It's one of the reasons you're allowed to go to Eretz Yisrael. You're allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael. But as they cross over into the border and they're on their way, they start to cry. V'koru big dayim, and they tear kriya. V'koru es ha-mikra hazeh, v'yirashtem otav, v'yashavtem ba, v'shamartu lasod et kol ha-chukim ha-eil, et ha-mishpatim amru, and they say, Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael, shkula k'neged kol ha-mitzvot shebetorah. Living in Israel is as valuable as any other mitzvah. Chazru ubo lehem l'Eretz Yisrael. So they turned around and they went back to Eretz Israel, and they said that's enough. So again, my suggestion is very simple, that you know, most people that get to the airport, they're worried about the, you know, which lounge they're getting into, they're worried about getting an upgrade, they're worried about all kinds of other things. And most people get to the airport, and what are they concerned with? They're concerned with all kinds of other things. No, they should have a place in the airport before you get on the plane. You're about to leave Eretz Israel, they should have a razor over there that people can tear Kriya before they leave. Why in the world should the only Kriya that they tear, oh, Eretz Israel is not what it should be, and therefore I'm going to tear Kriya? No, there should be a Kriya when you leave. You land in JFK, you get to Teaneck. You get there, that's the point that they should be able to, that they should be tearing Kriya. And it's interesting, you know, to read this Sifri, but as I said, it's all based on these psukim, v'yirashtem, v'yashavtem ba, that we're supposed to build a perfected society, build an elevated society, a society which is full of kindness, a society where families are together, not where families are sacrificing their children. It should be a society where those who are the have-nots and they need something, you open up your hand and you lend and you share, because that's who we are, and that's what it is. And again, the laws of Tzedakah are connected to this whole agricultural society which is being built, and that's not an accident. So as you read through Parsha Re'eh, please don't read each pasuk by itself, right? Analyze each word and letter by itself. Look at the bigger picture. That's what I said. I was very concerned today with what I'm calling the macro message of this. And when you look at it as the macro, then you see some of the connections that I'm pointing at. And to me, perhaps the starkest one really was between the Molach on the one hand and the celebrate with your families on the other hand. And I just not convinced that we notice that until you look at the bigger picture over here and about being able to create this this greater society. And those of you who visit or have to leave or live here and have to leave at some point, somebody asked me again this morning, do you miss traveling? I said, no, I don't miss traveling. I'm very happy over here. So anyway, but people should have this sense. You have to leave. Okay, there's reasons to leave. There's reasons you're allowed to leave and so on. But we should make every single person who leaves, make them tear kriya before they go, and say, follow the chacham and the sefri. There's as I said, I think there's a very powerful educational message. So I'm going to stop this Zionist diatribe. If I made anybody feel uncomfortable, obviously I apologize for everything that I've said. I didn't mean anything, and you don't have to complain to me or go to your therapist and say what a kind of a mean rabbi I am. And as I said, I ask for forgiveness. I'll call you B'li Neder Erev Yom Kippur. I'll ask for forgiveness. But what can I do? I like the Sifri, and it's worthwhile.